Never you forget to pray. What them say?
I'll leave you with this one.
Bad mind people get burned. Yo, one chapter there. Keep the devil away. Never you forget to pray in the morning. One chapter a day. In the morning. One chapter a day.
And enjoy.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
January is over, so welcome to the February 1st, 2024 edition of No Borders Media. No Borders Media is part of CKUT's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. On today's show, we feature an interview with an advocate and organizer for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental justice, Judy De Silva, a member of the Grassy Narrows First Nations in northwestern Ontario. Judy was in Montreal earlier this week to receive the Radio-Canada Prize for Scientist of the Year, an award she shared with three researchers and scientists based in Montreal. The award was for research into the effects of mercury poisoning on the community of Grassy Narrows, research that was crucially facilitated by Judy. More generally, the Grassy Narrows Ojibwe community is an epicenter of struggle and survival against corporate and state violence perpetuated by logging companies, mining companies, and now the nuclear industry, with the active complicity of the Ontario and Canadian governments. We explore all these topics and details with Judy De Silva, who spoke to us by phone from her community in Grassy Narrows in northwestern Ontario. No Borders Media will be broadcasting regularly this year. Locally in Montreal, you can hear us on the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. as part of Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. But you can also listen to our own regular podcasts and broadcasts. Check out No Borders Media on SoundCloud and our active social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky Threads, Twitter, and Mastodon, for links and upcoming and previous shows. No Borders Media shares and creates content in support of the struggles of the working class and oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. Let's go to our interview with Judy De Silva from Grassy Narrows right now. I'm speaking with Judy De Silva. Judy De Silva is an organizer and advocate for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental justice. She's an elder and member of the Grassy Narrows First Nation in northwestern Ontario. I'm speaking to Judy right now from Grassy Narrows. Judy, welcome to No Borders Media.
Hi, bonjour.
Judy, you were recently in Montreal, and you received, along with some colleagues of yours, an award on medical research into the effects of mercury poisoning on your community. So, first of all, congratulations on that award. And can you tell us a little bit about the process and what went behind the research into mercury poisoning in your community by a pulp and paper mill plant in Dryden, Ontario? Give us a little bit of the context of the research you undertook that led to this award.
Okay. First of all, I guess the award was awarded for scientific research, and then it was with Dr. Donna Mergler, a world-renowned mercury expert, and Dr. Aline Philibet, I guess you'd say, Dr. Marion Fillion, and they're all like doctors from Montreal, and they started working with us. I think it was around 2014, but anyways, it had to do with mercury poisoning, and then the place where we live is called Grassy Narrows, and we're like kind of like in the center of Canada, and the place we are located, this paper mill dumped 10 tons of mercury into the river system. And I wanted to explain a little bit, because people get this misinformation in their mind that the mercury is floating in the water and we drink it, but that's not how we get poison. The way you get poison is mercury is a heavy metal, and then when they had dumped it in 1960s, it went into the sediment, So the sediment is the mud that's at the bottom of the river. And as you know, a river flows. So the mercury got carried down towards my community, which was 200 kilometers downstream from the Dryden Mill. The Dryden Mill was owned by Reed Paper Company at the time, and they made paper, and they call it craft. So I don't really know what that means, like craft mill. So that's what they produced. And then the way we got poison was the bottom feeders, which would be like crayfish or little tiny fish would eat the foliage in the bottom of the river, and they would eat that, and then the bigger fish would eat the little fish, and they'd go up the chain till we got to a human being. And by the time it got to the human being, the mercury had become so toxic that when we ate the fish, we got poisoned. So that's kind of like the small background of how we got poisoned by mercury and how the study had started.
That was a great introduction. But maybe tell us the results of this research that you, as an environmental officer of your community, along with these three researchers from the Montreal area, what were the results of the research that you've undertaken since 2014? Share with our listeners maybe a couple of the highlights.
Okay, I'm kind of going to go into detail because I want to give back to my community. Like the doctors receiving the awards is like very prestigious, but at the same time, like I always want to remember my people, my community members that went through this research. You know, they volunteered, they're interviewed, they're poked, they're prodded, and they're asked questions. So I want to go back to that time. So before Donna Mergler was ever involved in Grassy, what I had heard was that the last health survey that happened was in 1990. And I thought, holy, we're already like in the 2000s, like it's like 10 years later. And I talked to one of our advocates named David Sohn in Toronto, and I said we need to reassess the effects of mercury on the people. And for 4 years, we met with the province to try and beg for money to do a health survey. And it was like pulling teeth, you know, like it was just like every time we really need this health survey to assess how the mercury has affected the people. And so it's like pulling teeth. We kept meeting. And then finally, we met Donna Mergler. David Sohn found her. And within a month, she had the questions done. Whereas with the government, it was like taking 2 years to create questions. And with Donna, it was within a month, she had it done. And so we finally got funded to do this health survey. And with this health survey, it was supposed to be like a door-to-door survey with two workers and two laptops like that. Well, the funding didn't come till December, and we're supposed to be done in March 2017. And so December, the funding came, and I told Donna, I'm freaking out. We only got a few months. I don't think we're going to get to everybody. So what we did was, well, what I ended up doing as an environmental health coordinator was we bought like 10 laptops and we hired like 10 workers. Instead of having two workers and two laptops, we doubled the volume, and we, Donna Mergler, trained them. And we're on, how do you call it? Kind of like a, we just started on a run, you know, like instead of like slowly, gently starting the health survey door to door gently, we did it like really aggressively. And we did it late into the night. Like the surveyors would have two laptops, they grab two laptops and they go and interview like people. So we're like running all the way till I think around February. Then Donna had to have the results. She had to figure out how to do the results. And then we had to have like a summary by the end of March, you know, like that, or something like, oh no, I think we had to be done in March. So that's kind of how this award came about. Was after that was done, when they did that, they found these really shocking findings based on the health survey. And I think it was 800 people we successfully surveyed door to door, including children, young people, and there were questions in there. When I talked to Donna, I said, how are we going to figure out, you know, that people are poisoned by mercury? And so her being a world-renowned mercury expert, she was able to put in the Survey Monkey. It's like a version of like doing the survey online, or she was able to ask questions in there that showed mercury poisoning. And based on that, she got funding. I think it was the University of Quebec. She got funding to do the Niebuhr study. And the Niebuhr study was like an after effect from the health survey. Because of all the findings they did, they started doing it more in-depth study on the reserve. And it took 2 years of her coming to, during COVID, I think was one. They came to Grassy with a whole team of like students plus Grassy people, and then they would do physical testing, like you know, like weighing the person and measuring the person's height, and then doing like a question on them again of like their health problems, and then doing eye testing. And so that took 2 years. So based on the community health survey and then the Niebuhr study for 2 years, they started seeing like really shocking results of how deeply affected the community people of Grassy Narrows were with mercury poisoning. So that's how it all, just going like really into detail of how we came up with all the answers that led to the science award.
Yeah, I want to remind our listeners that we're talking about a community that, I mean, it's your home and where you live, but it's, you know, relatively speaking, I guess it could be described as remote. It's in northwestern Ontario. It's north of Kenora. It's a small community of under 800 people, but I guess at maximum population, it was over 1,000 at some point.
1,600. Band members, but they live off reserve, so 800 live on reserve.
Right. And this is an issue. I mean, the pulp and paper mill that was discharging this mercury into your local river, the Wabigoon River, that happened in the 1960s up until the early 1970s. People have been studying this since the 70s. So this is an ongoing multi-generational struggle. But I know it's a difficult topic to address, I mentioned that just to warn our listeners, but describe for our listeners what the effects of this mercury poisoning has been physically, mentally, psychologically, collectively on the community. What does that mean in terms of how it affects elders, adults, and children in the community over many generations?
Well, I could say, being on the ground, like being a mercury sufferer myself, like I would explain to the listener that this is a neurological, they call it neurotoxin. The mercury attacks the brain, and then the brain slowly deteriorates, and over time, the mercury keeps eating at the brain, and it starts at the stem, the brain stem. So that starts affecting the motor, how do you call it? I guess like coordination of your body. So you lose sensation of your feet and your hands. And the neurologist will, if they do testing, they use like a little sharp thing and they scratch the bottom of your feet, or they poke like up your calf, up your arm. And so then you don't feel these pokes. It feels like nothing. And they even like test your face with the sharp poker, and sometimes you don't feel it on your face. And there's things like happening to me that feel really scary. One of them is I can't swallow. And one nurse practitioner said to me, oh, you probably just forget, like you probably just don't swallow right. But in my mind as a mercury sufferer, what happens is it's just like the mechanism in my brain telling me to swallow disappears, and I choke. If I'm eating food, my kids will see me. My kids are adult youth now, and they'll see me and they'll say, mom's choking, and they'll run and they'll grab water, and they know it's like urgent. So the water helps push my food down because my mechanism of swallowing is gone. Like it just fades, it disappears. So that's part of that. And the other thing is, I think in like if you go back on like CBC or whatever, or interviews of grassy neurons, you'll see like some reporters commenting that the children have mental health issues, and so right away you think they're like slow or whatever. But what it is they're very, very smart kids. They know how to function. They can unlock a password to a laptop, and this, so like that kind of stuff they can do, but they can't talk. They talk gibberish. Not all the kids, but I would say like maybe less than 5% or even less than that, maybe 3% of the children in Grassy can't communicate. But the parents have learned to function with that. And I think we need more study on the children so they can get, you know, the proper help for the mercury poisoning. But one of the findings that Dr. Mergler, Alin, and Miriam found was that we are a faster dying population in Grassy. In Ontario, there's 133 First Nations. So that's what Dr. Don and Mergler and them used as a foundation of comparing notes with the Chiefs of Ontario Regional Health Survey. They used that as a comparison of 133 First Nations, and they said that we are a faster dying population. We don't have much elders. We die earlier and faster. And the other thing is, this is really shocking, is based on the Community Health Survey from 2017, they found that Grassy youth have higher suicidal tendency, still based on the Chiefs of Ontario Regional Health Survey, 23 times higher than all the First Nations in Ontario. And when we did that release last year of that report, a young girl had committed suicide 2 days earlier. And it's really sad to live in that kind of reality. And the way Dr. Mergler said is that it's connected to the mercury poisoning of why these young people feel this way. And it's like through the Community Health Survey, she was able to see, the youth were able to answer, you know, yeah, I do think of suicide. You know, so that's how she came up with that number, 23 times higher. So that's some of the results. The other thing that our people go through is called tunnel vision. So like if you put your, it's like you're wearing binoculars all the time and all you see is the center and you don't see the side vision. And so that's another thing that they're finding, but there's doctors that are they're not optometrists, but they're eye researchers are working with us right now, and they're seeing that the grassy people do have tunnel vision. Not all of them, but the ones that Donna Mergler and them studied in the Niepin study, they found some people with tunnel vision, but they function really, really well. They've adapted to this tunnel vision. And now this doctor is coming to Grassy to study us, Joe Nimmergut from Montreal. He and Benoit, they're studying the visual problems, but what they're studying is the adaption of the Grassy people to function like really excellently with this tunnel vision, and they want to share that with the children that may have tunnel vision and they may not have the mechanisms these older Grassy people had to learn to function with tunnel vision. So Dr. Joe Nemergut and them are studying how to pass it on to the children. So that's like a general overview of how we have suffered with mercury poisoning. And we don't call ourselves victims. We say we are mercury sufferers because it's happening as we speak.
It's something that I can't say enough, but I'll probably only say it once or twice during this interview. But the resilience, the survival, and the organizing of your community is inspiring. And it's something that's happened over decades. And, you know, Judy, mm-hmm. you've been a huge part of that. And I know it's not just you, but many others. So I want to mention that because this is very hard subject matter to listen to, the devastation mm-hmm. of a community due to the violence, the corporate and state violence aimed at your community. And just again, mm-hmm. to remind our listeners, we're speaking about a community, the Grassy Narrows First Nation, mm-hmm. an Ojibwe community in northwestern Ontario, north of Kenora. Just to place it for people, as you mentioned, Judy, it's like in the center of Canada, where near the Manitoba-Ontario border, just north of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. The community was forcibly relocated there in the 1960s. It's an economy, had a traditional economy, and people would eat fish and hunt animals. Mm-hmm. And those fish and animals were contaminated with mercury that was dumped into the river system over 8 years, tons and tons of mercury mm-hmm. in the early 1960s and 70s. And this has been described as one of the worst environmental disasters of Canadian history. But unfortunately, I don't think it's in the memory of Canadians that this has ever happened, because it just isn't on people's radars, because your community is marginalized and Indigenous communities in general are marginalized and oppressed in the Canadian state. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, you've been fighting for justice in various ways. And this recent research is just builds on evidence upon evidence upon evidence of the injustices that your community has suffered. And the compensation that you've been given has been literally peanuts compared mm-hmm. to what any community should deserve if a corporation and a government, in this case, both the Canadian government and the Ontario government, have direct responsibility for what they've inflicted on your community. We're speaking with Judy De Silva, who from the community of Grassy Narrows in northwestern Ontario, the Ojibwe First Nation of Grassy Narrows, which in my opinion is an heroic First Nation that has resisted the effects of environmental and cultural genocide over decades and decades, genocide perpetuated by corporations as well as the Canadian state and the Ontario government. Judy described in this interview so far the effects of mercury poisoning in the community research, medical research she has helped undertake to describe those effects that have had intergenerational effects in the community over decades and decades. But one other part of the resistance in Grassy Narrows that has sort of faded into memory because it's been happening so long is a logging blockade that popped off back in 2002, but has continued now for over 20 years. We're going on 23 years now. It's undoubtedly the longest logging blockade in Canadian history, perhaps in the world. But whether it's the longest or not, or whether or not it sets an Olympic record or not, what's important is what the resistance is. And it's, as I mentioned, it's sort of faded into memory. But maybe, Judy, you can help our listeners understand why this logging blockade should not fade into memory, and the resistance your community has undertaken to stop clear cutting of the forest around your community.
So I guess, like, overall, and when you think of the world and how industry functions, they have like this insatiable appetite to, you know, to feed the huge consumer hunger that we all suffer, you know, to live the life that we have. And part of that is this mill that's upstream of us, 200 kilometers upstream, but also right in Kenora is a warehouser. And even though it's 2024 now, their lot is full. And a lot is not just a small lot, it's like probably like acres and acres of I guess you'd say hectares of field, like football fields of poplar in their lots. So like that's the industry that we stopped in our immediate area. So Grassy Narrows is like I think they said it's like 2,500 square kilometers around, like a land base. That's where we stopped the logging. And this happened in 2002, December 2nd, 2002. And so our community members, well, back then it was like young youth people that helped stop the logging blockade then, and turned the logging trucks away, told them we don't want you on our lands, and so on and so on. And they have stopped since then. So there's no logging in our immediate area. The birds have started coming back that had disappeared. The moose still have not really come back. There's just a few moose that have slowly started coming back because their home was destroyed. So we're still like suffering the effects of the deforestation. But going back to mercury poisoning, that's where the mercury poisoning came from, was that industry. And the logging industry had like an overall devastating negative impact on my community, where like our social fabric in our lives was broken, and even the economic fabric of our lives was broken, and our food source was broken. So it goes on and on and on, like how the logging industry had broken this. So we're still like in a devastated effect in our community of 800 people, like still trying to rebound from that destruction. And it's taking time, even though it's 20 years that we've stopped the logging in our area. 20 years is like a micro passage of time in terms of trying to rebuild our community. So that, like, that's bringing you back to today, 2024. And we did stop logging in our immediate area, but I have to be realistic and tell you they're logging all around us. So probably like if you did like a drone footage, you know, just going up in the air and then going back like maybe a few kilometers, or like you would see the devastation that's all around us. because we stopped logging in the middle of us, there's still logging happening. So just letting you know, Weyerhaeuser is still thriving. Probably if you Google Weyerhaeuser in Kenora, you'll see the millions of dollars of profit they've been making still. And Dryden Mill is still fully functioning. If you go to Dryden, you see the smokestacks going. And we have not destroyed them. Like, we have not stopped their companies. They're still benefiting from different forests right now, but not in Grassy.
One of the truly inspiring moments for me was to visit your community in 2002, just a few months after the blockade had started. And I know, you know, you've already mentioned that, you know, 20 years in one way is, you know, a small amount of time in terms of generational healing, but another way it is quite an achievement. Maybe remind our listeners of how that blockade took shape, because it's not as if, you know, you had to have hundreds of meetings and mobilize a lot of people. It was a very spontaneous effort by the youth of the community, many youth now who are, of course, grown up and contributing to their community in other ways.
So, like, just to refresh people's way of thinking, like, in terms of social activism and I guess I would even say desperate activism, because we were like up against the wall, you know, seeing the logging industry was getting closer and closer to our community, and hunters and trappers were saying, you know, like one weekend their hunting ground was there, and then the following weekend it was like a desert. So that's how rampant the logging was taking place in our territory. So it was like last second, like stopping, like we were desperate and we had to do something. And these three youth at the time went and started like going into the forest, and they cut trees down in desperation to try and stop the logging trucks. And their dad went, because they I guess their car broke down in the forest. The dad went and helped them get out of the forest, and the young people weren't dressed warm, but they did their desperate measure to activate the anti-logging campaign. And like, I always give it back to the community, like it took the heart of the whole community to start the logging blockade. It wasn't just like a few people, it was like a whole community that felt this desperation. And so that's how the anti-logging campaign started, was just, and the young people would stand in front of the logging trucks. And so, like, just simplifying it for, you know, people that want to protect the land, like, it takes one person to do it, and then you inspire the other people that are feeling the same to stop this monster. And that's what it was with Grassy, was like it took these few people, and then it was a growing movement within the community, and they all like say, yeah, we want to stop the logging. It's destroying our water, it's destroying our forest, it's destroying our way of life. So it's like it took those few people, because we're all of the same mind, you know, to make them feel like, yeah, we could do this. So that's like just a short version of like how a simple thing can grow into something that's now 20 years old. And since then, like, the young people are now, I know of one that's now a grandmother. And, you know, they've had their kids now, and now there's this new generation of younger people that have grown with that history of Grassy being blocking road, protecting the forest, protecting water. And I was so inspired by these young people that made a song And if you look on YouTube and you put Grassy Narrows home to me, you'll hear that song that they made, and their words are so powerful in the song. So I hope that answered the question.
Absolutely, Judy, absolutely. And honestly, the attacks on your community are never ending. So, you know, as you mentioned, it's been inspiring to see this decades-long blockade prevent logging from your immediate community, but still the forestry companies still log around, which obviously mm-hmm. has effects on your community. And now you're resisting the potential of mining on your land. So can you describe what's happening around the attempts to do heavy metal mining in your community or near your community?
I think, like, just I always trying to look at things in a bigger picture so that I can, like, understand things. And I think, like, in the Ring of Fire, which is like in Ontario, it's just like a circle of minerals that industry is after, and then we're outside of that field of the Ring of Fire. But in Grassy Narrows, we still have many, like, our community is rich in rock minerals, and industry is really after them. Like, it's like super, super hungry. Like, they're saying, oh my God, there's all these minerals in Grassy, or we need them, we want them. You know, that's kind of like the feeling that they have, you know, on our territory. And if you come to Grassy, it's like an hour and a half drive into the forest. It's like a lot of waters, a lot of cliffs, a lot of rock. And I think that the mining industry, I think it was almost like a couple of years ago now, we had like 4,000 applications just within Grassy Narrows area for like mining, they call it like mining applications. And then it went up to 6,000 applications. That's just in our territory, within our area. So imagine all those other places, like in Northern Ontario, remote First Nations, there's these people hungry for that. But our community is fighting against that. Our chief, Rudy Turtle, has been a champion in building an alliance with the remote First Nations, and they're on a roll, like, to stop the mining in our area. So that's one thing that we're fighting against.
And as I mentioned, it never stops, because there's also attempts to dispose of nuclear waste near your community. And just to provide our listeners with some context, the province of Ontario in Canada, which is the largest province, has nuclear power plants. And this is something that is increasing because of mm-hmm. climate change. And there's an effort to use nuclear power as a way of dealing with electricity needs and dealing with more electric cars and what have you. So there's waste produced by these plants, of course. And the first communities they look at to dispose of the waste is near Indigenous communities, so remote Indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So talk to us about your resistance to the lands near your community becoming a place to dispose of nuclear waste.
I guess to put it into context is, there's always this brainwashing way of thinking that, you know, the nuclear industry, but one of the things they say is the nuclear waste. There's like, holy geez, what I heard is that in Southern Ontario, it's just like, I think it's Bruce Nuclear Power Plant. They have like fields of these cubes with the nuclear waste in them. And they stack them on each other. And this is what they want to put onto probably in those boats and also in semi-trucks and transport to our area, which is about maybe like over 1,000 kilometers away. And they're saying like they're going to put it like close to Dryden, Ontario, and they'll bury it a mile into the earth. And they said it'd be like $1 million facility and all these cubes would be safely under the earth. But as you know, with nature and things like I would picture, they say they're safe, but as they're being transported across, you know, Trans-Canada Highway, you're exposing all these populations to like stacks and stacks of these cubes. And then you're going to bury them in the earth where the water runs. There's like microscopic cracks in the rocks that carry water. And then I picture, you know, these water would run up again to the Wabagoon River, to Grassy. And I'm picturing this within like maybe once the facility is built, within maybe 5 to 10 years, the leakage of the nuclear toxins would start leaching into the water. And then again, you know, our sicknesses would get really bad. So really scary, scary issue. We wouldn't be the only community exposed to be Dryden and all those communities. And as you go further, like Grassy, the water doesn't stop in Grassy. It goes to White Dog. It goes to Winnipeg River, Winnipeg Lake, and then up north into Hudson's Bay. So that's how the river flows. It touches all these communities and it goes all the way up north to the Hudson's Bay. So it's like if you picture the earth bigger and bigger, that's how the water flows. It would touch a lot of communities. So we're not the only ones exposed to that potential danger of nuclear power. And the deadline for contesting this is February 2024. So the First Nations all over Treaty 3 area have been like, I guess they're, how do you call it? There's the MOU signed with Grand Council Treaty 3 to work with the Nuclear Waste Management Organization. And I think the deadline to put in responses out is this month, February 2024. So we shall see what's going to happen.
You mentioned, Judy, in terms of mining, that part of the opposition to that has been an alliance by different chiefs, including within your own community, to resist the mining exploration. What is the opposition that has come together for this potential nuclear waste facility?
We started having, I think we had one community session in Kenora against nuclear waste, and that was last year, not 2023, it'd be 2022, we started that. And then all of last year, we were so focused on against mining and, you know, like against trying to protect Grassy Narrows. We never got full head into like to try and fight against the nuclear waste. And now the deadline's this month, so I'm having trust and faith in the Anishinaabe communities that we are going to really oppose this nuclear waste, because the deadline is this in February 2024. And I have to find out more about that. So I did see yesterday in Eagle Lake, they heard some kind of big movement of the earth, and they're saying that was the Mother Earth saying, you know, they don't want their earth destroyed, or they don't want the area destroyed. So I know the Anishinaabe people are, you know, they're powerful, and they, once they voice their concerns about the nuclear waste and about the mining, you know, we're a really strong nation. So I know we will stop it. It's going to be stopped. That's how I'm going to think. I'm going to think that way.
Judy, just to begin to wrap up our interview, I remind our listeners what an epicenter of struggle and resistance the Grassy Narrows community is over decades and decades and decades to against mercury poisoning, against logging, against mining, mm-hmm. now against nuclear waste. And of course, this happens in a context of broader struggles in the Canadian state for Indigenous peoples, campaigns for land back, reconciliation. There's been a reckoning about the legacy of residential schools. I know that there was a residential school near the previous Grassy community, which many people went to. So could you tell us your reflections and thoughts about the broader struggles? Because we focused in on Grassy, but you, of course, have been a participant in these larger struggles for Indigenous sovereignty, Indigenous justice, more broadly, for climate justice, for environmental justice. So talk about those broader issues as well as you would like.
Like when you're talking like this, like it kind of pulls my thoughts together, and then I think it reminds me that we are on the front line of a war against the First Nations. Like since the first contact that came to this land, this Turtle Island, and one of the things is that always comes back to my mind was like in the 1800s when the Indigenous people were fighting against like encroachment on their territories and lands. We were strong fighters, you know, to protect our territories, but we also were getting massacred, were getting killed. And one of the things that that comes to my mind is also we're being starved out of our territories. They killed buffaloes, they killed like our food source, but it didn't stop us. And then they figured out if they take our children away, it kills our spirit. So that's how the residential school started. And they took masses and masses of our babies, our children from our homes. And they told our families, you know, if you resist, you'll be put in jail. You'll be put in prison. So our people didn't know what that was. And they let their children go because there's these black robes that came to our homes and pulled our children from our arms. And so it broke. That's how the beginning of the encroachment of our land started. Was the bottom line was they're after the land, but they had to kill our spirit. They had to hurt our spirit for us to be weak so that we will be out of the way. And now the other thing that's happening is the missing, murdered Indigenous women, boys and girls. That's another tactic. And all of that is in the way to get to our lands. And it's highly successful because the killing of our women, boys and girls is like, it kills our spirit, it hurts our spirit. The residential school syndrome is all part of that, like to get onto our lands. And one of the things my sister says, Roberta Kizik, is she says that get back on the land, be visible on the land, be active on the land. But what happens is a lot of our people move into the cities and we lose touch with our land and our resources and our water and all that. And I'm not saying like all the city people have lost touch with that, but it's like we there's so much movement away from the land source. Like where I live, it's 1,600 people registered, but 800 live on reserve. The rest live in like towns and cities and away in different countries and so on. So that's typical of many First Nations, is like when you're talking about land back, some of us that are in cities, our lives are so entrenched in city life that, you know, that they don't want to go home to their communities. Maybe bad memories or bad experiences, or they're just not connected to family on reserves. So it's a whole generational thing. We have to go back to empower our people back again to be connected to the land.
Judy, we only have a little bit of time left for this interview. So are there any final thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes. To the listener, I'd like to say, you know, that the Indigenous people on Turtle Island, we're not only fighting for our small communities, but we're fighting for the future of Mother Earth and for your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. So when we're doing this, you know, if you're in a high-level position in helping governing, you know, Canada or United States, you know, just be aware, you know, that you can help make the change. And or if you're young persons in university or college, you know, be that influence to say, yeah, these Indigenous people are helping us to survive on Earth. You know, let's go stand with them, or let's help make change. You know, we need your voice, we need your support, and, you know, don't always criminalize First Nation people, and be aware that we're trying to protect all of you when we're doing these things. Miigwech.
Judy Da Silva, Indigenous, an organizer, an advocate for Indigenous sovereignty and environmental justice, an elder and member of the Grassy Narrows First Nation. Thank you for speaking with us on No Borders Media.
Miigwech. Thank you.
Thanks. That wraps up the February 2024 edition of No Borders Media. We were listening to a feature interview with Judy Da Silva, Indigenous advocate and organizer for sovereignty and environmental justice from the community of Grassy Narrows in northwestern Ontario. No Borders Media is part of CKUT's Off the Hour at 90.3 FM in Montreal, www.ckut.ca on the web. We're grassroots community radio on the island of Montreal. No Borders Media, previously named No One's Legal Radio, will be broadcasting regularly this year, the first Thursday of every month from 5 to 6 p.m. as part of Off the Hour, but also on our own podcasts and broadcasts. Check out No Borders Media on our social media, including Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, Threads, Twitter, and Mastodon for links to upcoming and previous shows. No Borders Media shares and creates content in support of the struggles of oppressed peoples and in opposition to capitalism and colonialism. We'll be back live on Thursday, February 1st on CKUT's Off the Hour. Stay tuned for Upstage. We'll be right back.
Listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Good evening. It's 6 o'clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. Professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganiagaha language and Muniang in Anishinaabe Mohan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah Day, live in studio on Thursday, February the 1st, 2024. It's a rainy, mild evening in Montreal. You might need an umbrella if you're headed to the Siegel Center to see the launch of Diggers. It's a Black Theater Workshop copro with CKUT. So cool. How did I not get the memo about that? A big mare to the crew and cast launching that show. You can check it out until, I believe, February 17th. And yes, that is a Donna Bernard production, a brand new show from her about gravediggers in a small community. Warren Setsuelo is a part of the cast. Looks like it's going to be absolutely fabulous. You have a couple weeks to check that out, but don't wait. Siegel Center Studio, siegelcenter.org. I also want to say a big hello to the cast and team at Ricky, who launched officially at Wild